guardian.co.uk.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Classic.
Classics.
Classic.
Metamorphosis, written by Franz Kafka. One morning, when Gregor Samsa woke from troubled dreams, he found himself transformed in his bed into a horrible vermin.
The Legend of Sleepy Hollow by Washington Irving. Found among the papers of the late Dietrich Knickerbocker. A pleasing land of
one thing was certain, that the white kitten had nothing to do with it. It was the black kitten's fault entirely. For the white kitten had been having its face washed by the old cat for the last quarter of an hour, and bearing it pretty well considerably. So you see that
The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Read by Mary Woods. Chapter 1. The Prison Door. A throng of bearded men in sad-colored garments and gray steeple-crowned hats,
this
intermixed with women, some wearing hoods
this
and others bareheaded, was assembled
what is
in front
classic?
Of a wooden edifice.
This is a classic.
As the big clean-up begins at the end of the Olympic summer, all our thoughts are turning to legacy, what lasts and what doesn't. One thing is indisputably true. Long after the last sportsmen and women have vanished from track and field and the stadia have crumbled to dust, words and pictures are what will stay in our memories. Here's what one distinguished commentator had to say of an earlier sporting era, which seems oddly familiar for all that it is separated from us by nearly 80 years.
Nearly everything possible has been done to spoil this game. The heavy financial interests, the absurd transfer and player selling system, the lack of any birth or residential qualification for the players, the betting and coupon competitions, the absurd publicity given to every feature of it by the press, the monstrous partisanship of the crowds, with their idiotic cries of "play the game, ref," when any decision against their side has been given. But the fact remains that it's not yet spoilt, and it has gone out and conquered the world. It's easy to understand, though some austere persons elaborately refuse to understand, why these crowds in the industrial towns pay shillings they can barely afford to see 22 professionals kick a ball about. They're not mere spectators in the sense of being idle and indifferent lookers-on. Though only vicariously, yet they run and leap and struggle and sweat, are driven into despair, are raised to triumph. And there is thrust into their lives of monotonous tasks and grey streets an epic hour of colour and strife that is no more a mere matter of other men's boots and a leather ball than a violin concerto is a mere matter of some other man's catgut and rosin. I know they do not last, that happiness, that comradeship. I know that religion, art, politics would give them something infinitely truer and more enduring. That comparatively, this sport-turned-spectacle is a poor thing. Yet if it is a poor thing, it is their own, and I'm glad they have it, this uproarious Saturday plaything.
That was J.B. Priestley writing in 1934 about a football match in Nottingham, one of the cities he visited as part of his English journey. Priestley's, of course, best known to us today as a dramatist, not least for An Inspector Calls, which was so triumphantly revived by the National Theatre a few years back. but he also wrote 27 novels, as well as various works of journalism and literary criticism. His work is being painstakingly restored and republished by an independent publisher, Great Northern Books. They've already published new editions of two novels, Bright Day and Good Companions, and an essay collection, Delight. Now they're reissuing another novel, Lost Empires, as well as a new edition of English Journey. With me in the studio to discuss his legacy is his son, Tom Priestley, who's been closely involved with the project. Tom, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, I introduced him with a reading from a sports reading. It's not something one would automatically associate with your father, is it?
Not immediately, but of course, you know, as a youth, he used to play football with his friends and was in a team. There is an early surviving photo of his with his chums. And I think he even tried out for one of the Bradford teams as stalwart left back.
In one of his novels, in Good Companions, he has a bit of sport, doesn't he?
Well, it kicks off. The very opening is of a tide of flat caps as all of the spectators leave a big football match. So, yes.
As far as sport on the field goes, he was more interested in the spectators than he was in the actual players, wasn't he?
In a match, it enters in a way into the world of the imagination, which is a very important theme of how he functioned and what he was about. So watching a game or a sport that you're emotionally involved with takes you out of yourself. You go to another level, as it were. I mean, it can just be making a noise and shouting and rattles and screaming and abusing the opposition. But it can also be an expression of joy, which I actually think the Olympics was, and I think that was part of the magic.
And of course, it's also all about performance on the day. And as I said at the beginning, Priestley is most associated now with the theatre. And one of the people who's been involved with this great republishing initiative is Roy Hudd. And we managed to get him earlier on the phone. And here's what he had to say.
The revival of his theatre work has been the most exciting thing. But you either go to the theatre and get someone to play the parts for you, or you read the novels and you invent the parts yourself. Because his novels read a bit, they are a bit like Dickens in the fact that they are very theatrical, his novels anyway, I think.
You actually have done a foreword to the reissue of Lost Empires, which presumably is particularly close to your heart. It says, being Richard Herncastle's account of his life on the variety stage from November 1913 to August 1914.
Well, it's a bit before my time.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're not quite that old.
Give us a break. Nothing had really changed. I came into Variety on its last knockings, which was around the late 50s. But all the characters in Lost Empires were still there. They were still there. It was even sadder than Lost Empires when I came into it. Not because of my act particularly, although that did close a few theatres, but all the characters in Lost Empires were around in the late 50s when I was still there. There were magicians, great magicians, who would never let anyone even stand in the wings when they were doing their act in case they saw their secrets. There were old-timers who'd never really been anywhere but were just too old, but were just hanging on by their fingertips into the business. There were lots of young performers. There were lots of people putting it about. There were all sorts of characters like that. There were still digs, old-fashioned digs, you know, where the landlady would actually cook you a meal if you, you sent her what you wanted. She'd buy the grub and cook it for you when you got there. Things hadn't changed a lot from the 40s when Lost Empires finished.
Now, you talked about him being quite theatrical and rather Dickensian in his writing.
Yeah.
Is that because of his dialogue? Or what is that quality?
Well, I think it's the description of the characters as much as anything. And the dialogue, of course. I mean, the actual, the one that I did the revival of last year was When We Are Married. And boy, oh boy, the characters in that are just marvellous. They could be Dickensian characters. And I just had the great joy of playing Henry Ormonroyd, the photographer, who's drunk all the time. Well, I mean, it's all there in the writing, in his description and what he says. You don't really need to be a marvellous actor to play it. Just follow what he says. Mm-hmm. And they are theatrical characters. They're over the top, which is what it's all about. Like the best actors are over the top. Charles Laughton, Freddie Jones, people like that. are over the top. And Priestley wrote over the top characters, but they're real.
Does his fiction do that? Does it breathe that life into
it? Because you see, anybody who loves reading creates their own characters. And it's not very difficult to do it with Priestley's writing because they're so beautifully described and everything from the way they walk, from the way they talk, from the way they dress, the things they say, everything is there in the novel. So in effect, you are acting it yourself when you're reading it.
He also wrote an essay collection, which he did some lovely monographs of a lot of his favourite actors, including these a lot of comic actors, didn't he?
Yes, because he did love comics, you see. Though, funny enough, someone mentioned a comic to me, a Northern comic called Jimmy Learmouth, and I thought, I must find something about this guy. He died very young, and apparently from reports, he was terrifically funny. And then the only person I could get who ever wrote anything about him was Priestley. He described Jimmy Learmouth better than anyone, and he said about him, Priestley, he was one of the funniest comedians he'd ever seen in his life, and he was an expert on comedians. So he must have been pretty good, Jimmy Learmouth. But no one had ever heard of him until Priestley wrote about him. And you read what he said about Eric and Ernie and Hancock and people like that, and by God, he knew what he was doing.
Do you think that he is of interest to anyone beyond theatre archaeologists like you or theatre archivists?
Oh, and how, love. I mean, he's as interesting to people as Dickens is still today. Very much so. I mean, the theatre side of it is just only a personal thing. And he loved theatre. And, of course, you know, he played Henry Ormond, the drunken photographer that I did in the West End last year. And he played it himself, you know, in the West End, Priestley.
Roy Hudd there. Also with us in the studio is Andrew Dixon, who is theatre editor of The Guardian. You're a generation younger than me, almost, professionally speaking, I would add. What does he mean to you?
Well, I think what's so striking is that everyone knows the name J.B. Priestley and, you know, An Inspector Calls is a set text. I did it before GCSE. You know, I grew up around the corner from him near Bradford. This real sense that he's this sort of English icon. And yet, actually, of course, the plays still aren't often that widely done. I mean, An Inspector Calls, that Stephen Daldry production, which is 20 years ago, recently revived in the West End, that goes around. Time in the Conways is occasionally done. Rupert Gould did an amazing production of it at the National Theatre a few years ago. But actually, more broadly than that, in a sense, we don't kind of encounter them that much. And what's really striking is seeing those plays again, as they're rarely revived, is how unusual and how surprising they are, that Priestley has this reputation of being a sort of rather comfortable, rather safe dramatist. They're incredibly experimental and expressionistic and strange and weird and time-bending. And it feels, just even hearing descriptions of him as an observer of theatre and everything else, is that a sense that the more we find out about him, the stranger and more interesting he gets.
Tom, is this true as well of the novels?
It's very interesting. My father always said that he saw himself as a dramatist first and a novelist second. He felt that his true gift was in the theatre. But being a very broad writer, I mean, as you said in the introduction, he'd done practically everything, you know, starting from essays, reviews, biographies. You can't think of a form of writing apart from poetry. He did actually write a youthful book of poems, I think, in order that his words would survive the First World War, but when he survived himself, he destroyed them all. But I think there is a poetic quality which not everyone would necessarily see or appreciate, but I think in his descriptions and his use of words, I think there is a poetic quality. So just to mark him down as being a sort of dull old stick is not to fully appreciate his gifts.
Do you think that people do mark him down as a dull old stick?
I think that there was, for a long time, there was the kind of elite versus the middle brow, in which he's not worth bothering about, because he's just sort of a popular novelist. And it's ironical that now, you know, books are sold, the big bestseller, as if then, right, so you have to go and get it. When he wrote The Good Companions, which was an incredible and unexpected bestseller, of course, then, fine, he's just a cheap bestseller writer, so of no significance.
Tell us about The Good Companions. What happens in it? What's it about?
Well, The Good Companions, which has a certain relationship, if you like, to lost empires. Those sets post-First World War, Lost Empires, of course, is pre-First World War. Good Companions basically is about three very different people. The Yorkshireman who storms out of his safe job to find life, in a way. Then there's the Miss Trance, the daughter from a sort of respectable Cotswold village, who inherits some money and decides to go off. And then Inigo Jolyphant, who's a sort of a young failed schoolmaster with a great talent for music. And the three really set off to have an adventure, to sort of find themselves. By a whole series of coincidences, they end up meeting this group of players.
There's a lot of storming out of a safe life, isn't there, in his work? Do you think that's how he saw himself?
It's one way of putting it. I think it's about people finding themselves and then being themselves rather than being sort of stuck in a caste that, you know, they think, oh, I have to do this and I must do that. So it's about freeing yourself from those kind of social inhibitions.
And another thing that he has that comes up again and again is this: is the idea of a magical person who sort of takes people out of their humdrum lives. I mean, this relates to Inspector Calls, doesn't it? This sort of magus. We don't know who he is or why he's there.
Well, it's absolutely incredible. You know, I mean, in Inspector Calls, you know, is constructed like just absolutely straightforward police drama. And then, of course, the incredible avant-garde technique of making your central character, the inspector himself, entirely fictive. You know, it's simply an instrument of the dramatist. And I think that's what I find so striking about it. And really good directors can bring out that sense of pushing at the boundaries of theatrical form and making things that seem completely improbable entirely probable and playing with what the sense of reality is. But then tying it, and I think what's really interesting about Priestley, and it comes across in his journalism and other kinds of writing as well, is with a social awareness and a sense of what Britain is and what Britain can be. And I think what, you know, we were talking about Dickens earlier and that sense of characterisation and slightly larger than life theatrical characters. I think it's also that Dickensian quality of observing what is really going on in Britain and finding, as it were, the thumbnail sketch or the character who can actually represent something much broader, much more socially interesting. And I think he's got that knack as well. And that's what makes him, in a sense, far more interesting than someone like Ibsen, for instance, who isn't very interested in those kinds of concerns. I'm just struck by its Englishness. And I suppose, in a sense, what perhaps condemned him for so long, at least critically, this idea that perhaps he was a kind of middlebrow writer, maybe more of a Betjeman than an Orwell, is that the issue? Is actually sort of bringing those things together. So you have incredibly Strindbergian theatrical techniques, but then you also connect them to a sense of what's really going on in England. You know, you are as interested in theories about time and sort of essence of quantum mechanics as you are about what happens at football matches in Nottingham. And that's a very particular English combination, I think.
Orwell, he was one of the people that Orwell denounced, wasn't he? He was in Orwell's little book of communist sympathisers.
This is a big and slightly dangerous topic, the relationship between Orwell and JBP. Because, for instance, English Journey came out before the Road to William Pier. But, of course, because Orwell is respected by the elite, because actually he's sort of one of us, on the strength of five books, he does have an incredible reputation. Yet he was a kind of upper middle class man who then chose to slum it.
Tom, Roy was talking about his gift at characterisation. Tell us, talk a bit about that from your point of view.
Well, I think what links the novels and the plays are indeed the characters. And I think that they would form themselves in his mind even before he put pen to paper. So I can remember when we lived in the Isle of Wight and we'd be waiting for the car to come to take us to the ferry during the time that usually he was writing in the morning, and he'd be sort of pacing around the hall. And I'm sure, without him ever saying it, that he was there rehearsing in his mind who the characters were and what they were going to do. And when we talked about novels in an interview I did with him, did I think that stories were more important than characters? He said, no, characters are always the first thing. And often the characters, when you get to know them, they will lead you through the story. So in a sense, they themselves are making the story happen. Now, if a play is properly and well cast, it will sort of run itself. Because with the right cast, the characters come alive.
I've always been a grumbler. All the records, going back to earliest childhood, establish this fact. Probably I arrived here a malcontent, convinced that I'd been sent to the wrong planet, and I feel even now there is something in this. I was designed for the part, for I have a sagging face, a weighty underlip, what I am told is a saurian eye, and a rumbling but resonant voice from which it's difficult to escape. Money couldn't buy a better grumbling outfit. In the West Riding of Yorkshire, where I spent my first 19 years, all local customs and prejudices favour the grumbler. To a good West Riding type, there is something shameful about praise. But fault-finding and blame are constant and heavy. The edge of criticism up there is sharpened every morning. So the twilight of Victoria and the brief but golden afternoon of Edward VII discovered Jackie Priestley grumbling away, a novice, of course, but learning fast. A short spell of the wool trade, and in no trade do you hear more complaints and bitter murmurs, developed my technique. Then came the First World War, in which I served with some of the durest, unwearying grumblers that even the British Army has ever known, and was considered to hold my own with the best of them. After that, a rapidly ripening specimen, I grumbled my way through Cambridge, Fleet Street, and various fields of literary and dramatic enterprise. I've grumbled all over the world, across seas, on mountains, in deserts. I've grumbled as much at home as abroad, and so I've been the despair of my womenfolk. Not that they've ever understood what I was up to. We've always been at cross purposes here. The feminine view appears to be that grumbling only makes things worse, whereas I've always held that a fine grumble makes things better. If, for example, an hotel gives me a bad breakfast, I've only to grumble away for a few minutes to feel that some reasonable balance has been restored. The grumble has been subtracted from the badness of the breakfast.
Those classic Priestley reissues are published by the Ilkley-based Great Northern Books. Now, Penguin has long had an imprint entirely devoted to classics, and it's now extended the definition to include authors who are still writing. They're a select bunch, and one of them is Javier Marías, who has long been regarded as one of Spain's greatest contemporary novelists. He's a colourful character who has inherited the title of King of the remote island of Redonda. He awards honours and prizes to writers and film directors he admires. One of the latest is Jonathan Coe, who joins Pedro Almodovar, William Boyd, Pierre Bourdieu and such like as the Duke of Prunes. I think that's how it's pronounced. But when it comes to his own work, the Madrid-based writer is deadly serious, as befits one who has just had four of his works, The Man of Feeling, Tomorrow in the Battle, Think of Me, A Heart So White and All Souls, published as Penguin Classics. When he came in to talk to Richard Lee, he began with a reading from The Man of Feeling, which is about an opera singer who conceives a fatal attraction for a woman he meets on a train.
Everything that he said I heard in this morning's dream exactly as it was spoken then, but on the other hand I do not think I could repeat it with the same exactitude, at least not this evening when I am tired and hungry. It's getting dark outside and I still haven't had any lunch and will not have any lunch. I can only reproduce fragments of what Manur said, but with the exception of myself shortly afterwards, except I cannot make an exception of myself, I have never seen anyone with such a will to persevere in his choice and in his love. More than that, I now know that it was Manur who infected me, or rather that I was the one who exposed myself to contamination or chose to imitate him. For until then, there had been only my desire to go on seeing Natalia Manur every day, my physical desire for Natalia Manur, and my desire to destroy Manur.
What's it like now? How does it feel to be a modern classic?
Well, to be a modern classic, according to Penguin Modern Classics, which is a lot, I must say, for me personally at least, because when I was a student and I studied in Madrid, I studied English linguistics. Of course, I when I was 17, 18, 19, I was buying Penguin Modern Classics all the time. Penguin Modern Classics then were some of my heroes like Joseph Conrad and Henry James and William Faulkner and Scott Fitzgerald and James Joyce and Virginia Woolf. So I suppose that the times now are less demanding. And I can't help but thinking that it's rather unfair to those people whose books I cherished so much when I was a student. Nothing is definite, nothing is definitive, we could say, and certainly one of the least definitive things is how authors are considered. You must think that Shakespeare himself was not very well considered during the 18th and part of the 19th century, that Cervantes himself in Spain, for instance, was taken only as a comic writer for a long, long time. It was only when in the Romanticism, when some people started to see something more than a comic book. Of course, it is a comic book, but it's much more than that. And it's also a very sad book and certainly a very profound book. Now, what I can say is that A Heart So White or Tomorrow in the Battle, Think of Me, or even All Souls, three of the so-called modern classics now in Penguin, they are still widely read. I mean, they have lasted at least about 20 years or 15 years or something like that.
It's made a good start.
Yeah, which is a good start for today. So that makes me feel very grateful to readers and rather proud, yes, in that sense, that they have lasted so long in a time in which nothing lasts.
Much of your recent work circles around themes of betrayal, of interpretation, of translation, with narrators who often seem cut from the same cloth.
Yeah, they are cousins.
Yeah, they're also names and phrases which echo through. But you say that's not a process of rereading, that's not a process of building
No, that's a process of having a good memory. I still have a good memory, maybe because I don't use a computer. And that forces me to have a good memory. For instance, when I was writing this trilogy throughout all those years, I know that if you have a computer, you can exactly know when you said that sentence or where you used the word rain or whatever. I don't, because I don't use a computer. So sometimes I had to think, where did I say this? Was it in the first volume? Was it in the second volume? Did I say that that character's eyes were grey or did I say they were blue? And I had to leaf the previous volume.
Back to the manuscript.
And all that. So that forces me to have a very good memory. And then sometimes I use in my novels what I've called sometimes a system of echoes or resonances, which is not exactly a repetition of sentences or of images. But they come and go with variations. It's more like a musical thing, you know. And that forces me to have them in mind. And that happens in one novel and also from one novel to another. There are some key sentences that I've been using throughout my, not all my career, but a great part of it.
And so you think of those as one extended fictional project then?
In a way, yes. Afterwards, I do. Not beforehand. I never know what I'm going to write, and I don't even know if I'm going to write another book when I finish one. I don't have a proper project. Now, when the books are finished, you realize there is a certain coherence, among them, and that maybe they look like a project, but they were not.
Not as you were going along. The fragment you just read, when the narrator of The Man of Feeling talks about a writer feeling his way forward, it describes something of your own way of working, doesn't it?
Yeah. I usually don't know the whole story when I start writing, and I wouldn't like to know the whole story. When that has happened to me, and that has happened to me only with a few short stories, I was bored while I was writing them. For me, it's very important when I'm writing to find out the story as I write. But I improvise a lot, and in a way, I like to remind people that the word to invent, the verb to invent, comes from Latin invenire. And invenire in Latin, what really meant was to discover, to find out. So invention and finding out is, in a way, the same thing, well, at least etymologically it would be. Afterwards, when the book is finished, it seems impossible that it's not the way it is. But I know perfectly well that maybe 5 pages before coming to the end, I hadn't decided, and it might have been otherwise.
Your latest novel, Los Enamorientos.
Enamoramientos, that's a long word.
It's one that I stumble over partly because I haven't yet read the book, because I haven't read it in Spanish, of course. It's due out in English in spring.
It should be out in March, I think, yes.
Yes, I was wondering if you could tell those of us who haven't read it in Spanish a little about it.
This is my first novel in which the narrator is a female. All my novels since 1986 have been in the first person. And all my narrators have been cousins, as you could say. They are rather similar. They are not the same person, except in the case of All Souls and Your Face Tomorrow. I've realized that female narrator is not so different from my male narrators in a way. I mean, she's a cousin to them as well. And she falls in love with a man, and she wears a bra, and she has a problem with a bra at a given moment, and high heels sometimes, and all that, but she's not so different in the end. I think that precisely what you do with your mind is not the biggest difference between men and women.
There's a line in Tomorrow in the Battle, Think of Me, first published back in 1994, which rings strangely in 2012 when the narrator says that he was often interrupted, Telles often interrupted him to talk about things in the newspaper about the catastrophic situation in this plundered country of ours. Are the roots of the current economic crisis that far back?
Possibly, yes. I can't say. One of the problems that is very easily forgotten in Spain in particular now is that in 19... Aznar, you know, right-wing president we had for 2 terms, he won the elections in 1996, which was the 90s, obviously. And then a couple of years after that, I think it was, he passed a law, an absurd, crazy law, in my opinion, which, according to which all Spanish soil would be buildable.
You could build anywhere in Spain?
Anywhere.
Oh.
So they started doing that, and that's been one of the huge reasons for the so-called bubble.
Javier Mirias there talking to Richard Lee. At the end of last week's podcast, we asked for your feedback on our programmes, and several of you wrote in with good suggestions. Richard rejoins us to run through some of them for us.
Literary Reference said that he or she would like them to be a little bit longer, maybe something closer to 40 minutes, and that he'd welcome more on writers from the 17th, 18th and 19th centuries. David N suggested a feature on working class writers, if there are any. Are there writers in these challenging times, he asks, writing about ordinary lives the way that Brain, Norton, Story, Barstow and the like did in the 50s and 60s? I don't know if self-confessed working-class boy J.B. Priestley will address that concern in some way. And there's also Affirmative, Pied Warbler and Ab Madden, who all said they sometimes found the music a little intrusive. We'll definitely bear that in mind.
Pied Warbler also said, I'd love to hear what books Sarah and the other presenters are reading from time to time. Well, I can't speak for Sarah because she's off on her holidays this week. But for what it's worth, Pied Warbler, I'm reading Howard Jacobson's Zoo Time at the moment, and I'm finding it very funny in a Rabelaisian sort of way, despite the lukewarm reviews. How about you, Richard?
Well, as it happens, I've just finished Attica Locks, the cutting season. She's in to do a podcast interview later on today. That's very much the sort of thing whereby I've come to that book purely because she's around and she's an opportunity to interview her, a fantastic writer from the States. But there's a book actually that I've got at the top of my guilt must-read pile, which is a book recommended by Javier Marías as he was leaving the studio, by writer Guillermo Cabrera Infante, who I didn't know at all. So I've asked for some suggestions on Twitter, and I'm going to start with Three Trapped Tigers, which I think is apparently a great place to begin.
Many thanks to all of you for taking the trouble to feed back to us. If you drop me an email at claire.armitstead@guardian.co.uk, I will reward you if I have mentioned your name with those books I promised last week. The offer remains open, so if you've come to us through iTunes, just go to the Guardian Books website and click on the podcast tab at the top of the page. It's really very easy to sign in and add your comments to the thread. And that's it for this week. Thanks to Tom Priestley, Roy Hudd, Andrew Dixon, Javier Marías and Richard Lee. From me, Claire Armistead, and from our producer, Tim Mabey. Goodbye.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.